This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the governor calls the legislature into special session to pass a bill to fund disaster relief. They then call themselves into an extended special session to deal with other matters, including limiting Roy Cooper's powers and canceling the I-77 toll road. CMS announces their choice for a new school superintendent. The Dylan Roof trial speeds to its conclusion in Charleston. His defense rests without presenting any defense at all in his capital punishment murder trial, and he is found guilty on all counts. Poverty rates in Mecklenburg County are on the rise, and our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by Lisa Wharf and David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning and welcome to you.
Morning, Mike.
Morning.
And from the TV side, no print people today. We ran out of ink. On the TV side, Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News, is here, along with Sean Flynn, managing editor in the Charlotte newsroom at Time Warner Cable News. Good morning to both of you.
Hello.
Well, you can reach us through email at charlottetalks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. So what may have proven to be good news for those who suffered from Hurricane Matthew and the wildfires in the mountains has turned out to be not so good news for the incoming governor-elect. And, of course, we're talking about that special legislative session up in Raleigh called by Pat McCrory. Let's start with why he called it. He wanted lawmakers to consider a bill that would provide $201 million in disaster relief for folks in the mountains and along the coast. Why does it take a special session, Nick, to appropriate money for that purpose?
Well, one, because, you know, we just like to go back to Raleigh, it seems, this year. Two, and really, because they ended up appropriating $200 million, and a lot of that came from the Rainy Day Fund. There was federal money that was there, and so there wasn't, like, any specific authority setting down, we need to go this to that and that to this. So really, when they called for the session that dealt with disaster relief, it was specifically ironing out where all that money, $200 million, is a lot to steer, and so the lawmakers came in to steer it to the specific avenues, and that is what they did.
And they passed that bill, right?
Correct.
They
Correct.
Did pass it, and they spelled out in there, as Nick is saying, you know, some of it will go for housing, emergency and long-term housing. Some of it goes to economic development. Some of it goes to local governments to help rebuild downtown facilities, schools that are destroyed after the flooding.
And yet I read this morning that it's less money than they appropriated for Hurricane Floyd, and this goes for both hurricane relief for Hurricane Matthew and the wildfires in the North Carolina mountains. Is $201 million enough, Sean?
It's not enough, but I don't think that's the final plan. I think this was just to get it off the table, get some money flowing that direction. Pun totally not intended there. And then just, you know, eventually when they come back for the long session in a couple of weeks, then get some more money flowing.
Long
session. Lisa? That's a joke.
I was going to say, now we know, though, what any other matters means with the General Assembly.
Yes.
You know, of course, there was this $200 million, but there's a much longer agenda this week, including that.
Did the governor call them into session because he wanted those other things to come up? I mean, obviously, he knew that once you open the Pandora's box, it's open. So he knew that going into this, but did he call it because that was the agenda? Anybody know?
I don't believe so, no. In fact, the will in the House of Representatives was to only do disaster relief and go home. I think the will of most people in the building is they already wanted to be home, and most members of the Council of State, including some Republicans, only wanted advise and consent the governor on calling sessions, only wanted the legislature to focus on disaster relief. That being said, here we are.
Well, there was talk prior to this session coming into order that the lawmakers would use this as an opportunity to pack the North Carolina Supreme Court, because in the election, a Democrat now leads that court, and it now leans Democratic. But House Speaker Tim Moore had said that he and fellow Republicans had no plans to do that, and in fact, they didn't do that. What they did do, however, was make the appeals court. It has to go through an appeals. It makes it more difficult to get to the Supreme Court, right?
With constitutional matters, right?
It's not a requirement, okay? All it does is it adds an extra level of review if you ask for it. It's exactly the same system we have in the federal level. And this mirrors a bill that was introduced in 1995 and co-sponsored by Roy Cooper that would have added the same thing. But all it does basically, so right now at the Court of Appeals, you hear cases in three-judge panels. And if it's a 3-0 decision, then your case almost dies. You don't get an automatic right of of Appeal to have your case reviewed at the state Supreme Court. And it's nearly impossible to get discretionary review. The Supreme Court rarely says, yes, we'll just review that because we feel like it. So what adding an option to have the Supreme Court sit en banc is what it's called here as the full 15-member panel gives an extra layer of review. And then if they have a split decision, you can more easily get your case up to the Supreme Court.
But the appeals courts are controlled by Republican judges?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, the Court of Appeals is.
So it is a backstop.
It's not a backstop. It gives you an additional option. Because either way, it could still go. And if it's a big matter, it's still going to go to the Supreme Court. Because keep in mind, the Supreme Court can take whatever it wants as soon as it leaves the trial level. So, and this isn't a requirement that it go through the en banc hearing. It gives you an extra option. And as someone who had a 3-0 decision at the Court of Appeals and then barely got discretionary review and then had a 3-3 split decision at the Supreme Court, I can, commiserate with why we might want that.
So you guys at Time Warner Cable News, Sean, have been covering this almost wall-to-wall during the daytime when they've been in session. How many bills have they passed in the House and Senate?
Well, they originally, the special session, all of a sudden they're like, well, it's open to anybody and everybody who wants to throw one out there. And you had 21 thrown out there, including several by Democrats. So obviously they had that in their back pockets, including something that I'm sure we'll be talking about, the toll one. Yeah. Only a handful have actually moved forward past that, which is what they talked about when they opened up this fourth special session, that only two would probably move forward.
David?
And some of these bills are bills that have been kicking around in legislators' back pockets. Some of them we've seen before and they didn't go anywhere. But some of them are new things, and they weren't just cooked up in a couple hours on Wednesday. These are things that have been in the works by the Republican leadership for some time.
And, of course, the ones that are really getting all the headlines, I think the New York Times wrote an editorial about this morning, The Observer did, so did the Washington Post, have been the bills that look like attempts to limit the power of the incoming Governor Roy Cooper.
They don't just look like.
Well, they are, in fact, yes. And the timing, state lawmakers have said, yep, the timing is there. Yeah. We want to get this done before he comes in office.
It all sounds transparently political, but is it unprecedented, Nick?
Well, no. I mean, look, Republicans, before they even introduced their proposal, said what we're going to do is based upon bills that the Democrats did in the mid to late 90s, including 4 years while Roy Cooper was Senate Majority Leader from 97 to 2000.
But Democrats will say that these measures are far more restrictive, far more severe than what they did. That's not true?
Well, no, that's not true. And so we went back and dug through every bill passed from 1997 to 2000, because that's what kind of exciting life I lead. And what we found, and then some additional in 95 because I wasn't having enough fun. But anyways, what we found is, I'll give you a for instance, is a bill was passed in 1997 when Roy Cooper was Senate Majority Leader that limited the number of political employees that the governor could hire to just 100. Now, there is a proposal in the House, in House Bill 17, that's poised to move through the legislature today that would limit that number to 300. Now, that's a drastic reduction from what the legislature opened up for Pat McCrory, but,
Yes, they expanded it for him.
Yes, and we should point that out.
Yes, and what this also means is that Roy Cooper will be left with two-thirds of employees that he cannot fire who were appointed by the previous Republican governor. Aren't there political ramifications to that? He's working for people who may not be working with him.
Including in the Office of Management and Budget and in the personnel, two places where you might want some of your own people, absolutely. I think moving... It is true if the Republicans say, well, this isn't the first time the legislature's limited the number of political hires. That is on its face true because the legislature limited it far more than it is here. That being said, I think they have not limited in the management budget office and the HR office, and that raises a lot more questions.
But we talked to Governor Jim Martin, former Republican governor, and he said, hey, he had mixed feelings about this. He said, yes, Democrats did things like this to me when I was in office. So many of the things I'm all right with, as far as the exempt positions that Nick was talking about, decreasing them down to about 300. But he said what he really took issue was taking power away from the executive branch. For example, when you look at the UNC College's Board of Trustees throughout the state, he said he should still have those appointments. They should not take that away. And as far as the Department of Public Instruction too. He said, you know, the executive authority should be with the stay the same.
And Jim Martin knows what he's talking about because they did that to him.
He made that point several times.
And ex-Governor Jim Hunt, who is a Democrat, and Jim Martin have both criticized this attempt to limit the power of the governor as an office. And Republican Jim Martin has said some of the Republican proposals go too far. So there are Republican critics of this attempt to limit power. They cut Roy Cooper's ability to make appointments. Evidently, if this passes, they would have to be his cabinet appointments would have to be subject to the approval of the state Senate, which sounds pretty much exactly like what happens in Washington with cabinet appointments by the president.
And that's in the state constitution. It's never been invoked.
We'll come back and talk more about this and other issues that happened this week on the local news roundup here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Lisa Wharf and David Borax from WFAE News, Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News, and Sean Flynn, managing editor of the Charlotte Newsroom. We've added that as a disclaimer
of
Time Warner Cable News on Spectrum, on Time Warner Cable. Let's go back and talk a little bit more, and then we'll move on to other topics about the special legislative session that's going on in Raleigh. And I think, Nick, you just said off the air that they're going to attempt to wrap that up today, right?
That is what Senate Republican Leader Phil Berger told me yesterday.
Okay.
And I had begged him to just end it yesterday.
But he doesn't listen to you.
Who begged him?
I can't believe you're driving up and back every day. That's
true. I'm going to leave here because I'm so committed to Charlotte Talks. I am going to leave here and drive to Raleigh.
Well, that's how people find you. That's how people know you're a working journalist by listening to you here.
That's right.
All right. Republican legislators, among other things, have been suggested making Roy Cooper's appointments subject to approval, which we just talked about prior to the break. They also want to cut his ability to appoint members, and I think, Lisa, you alluded to this, appoint members to the University of North Carolina System Board of Trustees and the State Board of Education. Are they afraid that he might reverse changes that are underway at UNC with the new president there that Republicans put into place?
I'm not sure that he could reverse those changes, you know, and right now we're still seeing what those changes are. Not too much has really been playing out there.
Why are they?
Well, it's certainly another move to limit the power of the executive branch. And, you know, it's something that even they tried to do under Pat McCrory with the Coal Ash Commission, trying to establish that and get around his authority there. And McCrory and a few other former governors took the state to court. Well, who would they take to court? But and they lost that argument. Mm. They said the Supreme Court said, nope, that's executive authority. And so, you know, if this indeed goes through, which it looks like it will, you'll probably see another lawsuit. I mean, and they have just not had such good luck with that in the past.
Democrats have been saying that this is a power grab. And, of course, Nick, you said earlier that there is a precedent for this. The Democrats did this as well. But
which doesn't mean it's not a power grab.
There seems to be a modus operandi on the part of the legislature of going after things like Charlotte's airport and water systems around the state and boards of election around the state. They seem to want to be in charge of everything. And their argument, if I read this correctly this morning, was that this rebalances the scales, they say, by putting power back into the hands of elected people that the ordinary people can actually reach out and touch. They made mention of the fact that you won't see Roy Cooper as governor pumping his own gas in Marshville. You will see, however, perhaps your state legislator doing that. So is that because the governor's the only person in the state elected by everybody.
Right. But there's two things going on here. One is that I talked to our political analyst at WFAE, Michael Bitzer, yesterday from Catawba College, and he pointed out that North Carolina traditionally has been a state where legislative supremacy is the rule. Our Constitution is written in a way that does give the legislature priority on a lot of things. So that's important. But the other thing that's happening here, you know, it does fall into that category of power grab. Representative David Lewis, a Republican, you know, has said quite clearly, we want to make sure we're still in charge and we can stay in charge, basically.
But they are in charge.
They are, and they want to stay there.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to me that they even need a power grab.
Right.
Because they already are extremely powerful in so many different ways. Even look during the Governor McCrory administration, how many times did you think that the governor was just left there scratching his head wondering what his own party was doing? I mean, this state definitely has a strong legislative branch.
Right. And a weak governor. And a weak governor's
office.
In many
ways, yes.
Yeah, has always had a weak governor. And if you remember, there's the most powerful person in the state is whoever's leading the Senate, right? If you remember the days of Mark Basnight and Tony Rand in the 90s and 2000s, ran this state with an iron fist and got what they want. Right. And that tradition proudly carried over, apparently, into Phil Berger.
One of the other provisions that they are looking at would cut the number, would change the way the Board of Elections around the state, the heads of the Boards of Elections around the state are controlled. Right now, they are controlled by the party of the governor, which is Pat McCrory, a Republican, so they're all Republicans. They want to make it 50-50 split on this. Why? Because when Roy Cooper would take over, they would all become Democratic heads of boards of elections?
Well, all the heads would, yes. And right now, the state board is 3 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and that would swap to 2 Republicans, 3 Democrats.
And on all the county boards, it's 2 for the governor's party and 1 for the
Correct.
Yeah, but then this proposal is really intriguing, especially with the county boards of elections, because for them you need like the odd number. You kind of need an odd number most of the time, but they get around the idea, since it would be 3-2 of whoever, every other year, basically, the other party has control over those county board of elections. But they figured it out, and the way they worded it was that the party with the second highest number of voter registration in the state would get the even number years, which would be the Republicans, and which would be those big statewide
elections.
As voter
registration stands now.
Voter registration stands now, exactly.
Would the legislature be doing any of this? Would they have gone into an extended special session had Pat McCrory won re-election?
David Lewis, the House Rules Chairman, said no. They would not be. That this accelerated their timeline, the fact that we have a Democratic governor coming into office.
So what has our governor-elect had to say about this?
Go home.
Yeah, go home. Exactly.
Almost a verbatim quote.
I'm going to sue.
Republicans, go home.
Cooper has said that legislators should focus on higher teacher pay, better wages for working North Carolinians, and repealing HB 2.
We don't look good to our people here in North Carolina or to the rest of the country when laws are passed hastily with little discussion in the middle of the night. Witness the disaster of House Bill 2, which was passed in the same way. This has got to stop.
Any chance that it will stop? Any chance that any of what he talks about will be taken up in the future? Teacher pay, HB 2 repealed, etc.
I think there's some appetite with teacher pay to increase that. People have different ideas, even from the House to the Senate, about doing that. But I mean, I think that's one area where there's probably room for negotiation.
I don't think any of those things are going to come up in a way that Roy Cooper would have conceived.
Democrats,
that's a good way to put it.
Democrats in the legislature have also been critical of the special session. Obviously, we talked a little bit about this. Representative Darren Jackson of Wake said on the House floor, "This is why people don't trust us. This is why they hate us, because of this right here, using hurricane relief as the reason to come back to Raleigh to do a lot of things because you lost an election by 10,000 votes." Is that how voters in North Carolina see this?
It appears, I don't know, from my Facebook page that there are a lot of people unhappy about what's going on right now. I mean, if you look at the national headlines right now, right, it's, Republicans are, seeking to take power away from the new Democratic governor. And that's certainly the storyline that's coming out of Raleigh is exactly, as the Democrats would have it phrased.
Some of these bills, all of these bills will have to be signed into law by the governor. Is Pat McCrory likely to sign all of these, or especially when it comes to bills that would limit the power of the governor's office, no matter who's in the office, is he likely as an experienced governor to say, I'm not going to sign that?
So that option is open right at the moment. In fact, the Observer's editorial this morning suggested that McCrory could be the statesman that we all thought he was, by doing the right thing. And I'm not sure which of these bills he might veto, but they suggested that he might veto one or more of them.
Because he has nothing to lose by vetoing, right?
And it doesn't matter because there are veto-proof majorities in both the House and the Senate. So
if the governor vetoes it, you're saying that they will just go override the veto.
Correct. Correct. Although if Republicans think that he's going to veto and they're going to have to override, they've not indicated that because there does not appear anyone thinks that they're going to be back in session.
Have we heard?
McCrory, I don't think McCrory has said anything about this, right?
He hasn't said
anything. Said nothing, and I can't get anyone in that office to return my phone calls.
He's been up at the Trump Tower.
Well, I've got his cell phone number if you want to try text him. He won't answer my texts either. The governor-elect and the current attorney general also, he doesn't appear to be afraid of seeking judicial relief on these bills.
If I believe that laws pass by the legislature hurt working families and are unconstitutional, they will see me in court. And they don't have a very good track record there.
He's right about that. And the new attorney general is a Democrat, right?
That's correct, Josh Stein. That's correct. And it's interesting. So I asked Senator Berger in our interview with him yesterday, I said, you know, Roy Cooper says he's prepared to sue you. Are you prepared to defend this? And Republicans in the legislature have been critical of Roy Cooper's refusal to defend them on certain things. So right. Berger's response was, we'd love to see him in court. It'd be the first time.
How much money are we spending on lawsuits? Because the attorney general is Roy Cooper is not defending the state. They have had to hire outside counsel.
Like $1 million.
Okay.
And it was $900,000.
Everybody's got their own lawyers now, and that's not going to change after January 1st.
Of great interest to people in this area is the effort by three Mecklenburg County lawmakers, Democrat Tricia Cotham and Republicans John Bradford and Justin Moore, to cancel the contract with I-77 Mobility Partners on the 26-mile toll lane project from Charlotte to Mooresville. That was brought up in this special session. Has it gone through debate? Will it pass? Will it be signed?
That's on my list of bills that probably won't go anywhere. The bill was referred to the Transportation Committee in the House. It's similar to a bill that passed in the House during the last session, and there was great hopes among the opponents of the toll lanes that something would happen, but it went nowhere in the Senate. I think this time it goes nowhere in the House, and I hear that there's not really any appetite to take it up in the Senate again. So I would not get my hopes up if you are a toll lane opponent.
But surely these three lawmakers know that. Is this simply to say, to put themselves on record for having tried to do something for their constituents?
There's an election coming up at some point. Yeah. So
that's what it's about. Let's move on to the Dylann Roof trial. Yesterday afternoon, I think about 3:45 or so, he was found guilty on all counts, all charges. It was a short but emotional trial in which the defense rested immediately after the prosecution did. Were there any surprises in anything that happened down there in Charleston?
Not at all. I think this was one of the most open-shut cases that there's ever been. Mm. And I don't if you heard the defense's closing arguments, there wasn't any arguments. It was, he did a lot of bad stuff.
Well, he's admitted it.
Yes.
Yeah.
They saw it. So I think the defense was just waiting for the sentencing phase to do their job, which is to try and keep him off out of the death penalty.
And the words that the defense was using, absolutely. I mean, they didn't say he was not guilty of this, but they used words like abnormal and things that made me kind of wonder about if they were trying to smooth things for the sentencing phase, right. Which
I think at one point they blamed the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, he's elected at the moment. Dylann Roof has decided he wants to be his own, represent himself for the sentencing phase. And we had some experts on this program a couple of weeks ago to talk about this. And one of the things that defendants who end up defending themselves and never do well when they do, sometimes their motivation is to prevent the mental illness defense from coming out in court, that they don't want to be perceived as mentally ill or mentally incompetent. Is that what you think what's going on here? Because obviously, you mentioned yesterday the defense was kind of setting the stage for that by laying some groundwork.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going to happen when he takes over in the sentencing phase, I have to say. I mean, it's going to be interesting.
I think there's some people who are concerned that he's going to take over and continue some racist rants and turn the trial into a
platform, really.
Platform, and I think that's a big concern for a lot of people because he appears to have made is not concerned about getting the death penalty, at least previously.
Well, weren't they going to? He was going to plead guilty if they took the death penalty off the table. So maybe he is concerned about it because he decided to go ahead with the trial.
Well, I mean, even going through testimony, he kept one bullet in his chamber of his gun, and that was supposed to be for himself.
Right.
So obviously, he's thought about it, but it might be a situation where he keeps going back and forth.
And he said, "We all know I'm guilty." In a taped confession to the police, plus the testimony of one of the people in the room during the shootings, family members, the video of him exiting the church, gun in hand, etc., that pretty much sealed his fate from the start, did it not?
Absolutely. And I think the one thing that the prosecutors did really well is, I mean, obviously everyone knew that he did it. He admitted that he did it. But they did a really good job of showing the months leading up to it, how he spent probably at least a half a year thinking about doing this. Mm-hmm. They used a GPS analyst from Garmin, you know, the little tracker in your car, to show that there were breadcrumbs around Mother Emmanuel AME Church in December of 2014, again in April of 2015, and then June 17th. So it shows that he was there almost stalking them.
Yeah, and we've discovered, obviously, he had a list of churches, other black churches in the area that he was that could have been contemplating going after. Had this,
and the prosecutors really have made their case already for why he should get the death penalty.
Yeah. The sentencing part of this trial goes on in January, and then he's off, I think, to the state trial, which is also a death penalty trial. When we come back on the news roundup, we'll talk about Charlotte Mecklenburg's new superintendent of schools and more. On Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Lisa Wharf, assistant news director and reporter for WFAE News. David Borax, also from our news department here. Nick Oxner with WBTV. And Sean Flynn, managing editor of the Charlotte Newsroom for Time Warner Cable News. Lisa, Dr. Clayton Wilcox will become a very familiar name to Charlottians in the coming months. He is now superintendent of Hagerstown, Maryland's relatively small school system. He's been named to head the CMS system. What do we know about him?
There's a lot we don't know about him. And, we found out that he was going to be superintendent on Wednesday. I believe that was the press conference.
And he wasn't there.
And he was not there. Mm-hmm. He was not there. And, of course, this selection process was very different than the past selection process because it was all done in private. There were concerns that you couldn't get as high a caliber of someone if it was a public search. And so they made this announcement and said that he was going to be the next superintendent. And it was about 10 minutes. They took a few questions, and it was kind of a weird announcement. I mean,
very weird.
Explain that to listeners who don't go to press conferences. Why was it weird?
Well, usually there's a lot of gushing when the next superintendent is coming, and they really play up all the great things that this person has done. And this time, there was really very little of it.
No.
They said
as a football coach is hired. Yeah. And they have a conference, and he's there, and shirts are given, and all kinds of things. It was nothing like that, Lisa.
Everybody's congratulating themselves on the back. Great job. We got the person we wanted. Not this time.
Yeah, look, contrast the announcement of city manager Marcus Jones, you know, who was here, he's going to be the next forward thinker, blah, 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 to this announcement about Dr. Wilcox. And
yeah.
And I was just going to add, I mean, they even said, one of the school board members said, it was a really hard decision to make, which then you're like, okay. And then normally in years past when I've covered these things, whether it be the city, county manager, CMS superintendent, whoever it is, whatever governing body it is, they make their decisions, their vote, 4-3, whatever the vote happens to be. And then they take another vote. It's unanimous now. This is the person we want. Not this time. They're like, yeah, it was 4-3. We chose this guy. Yeah. So all of a sudden, right out of the bat, this guy's already got a lot of people going questions and about
you. Read in the paper this morning
exactly.
That a guy running a bigger system dropped out of the contest shortly before they made their
so
decision.
Not even their first choice,
right? Because his wife didn't want to move here, which puzzled them. so are we to assume then that this was hit their second or third choice?
Well, as the as the Observer reported, you know, then that left them with the two semifinalists. And that decision, it sounded like, was very split. It was going back and forth.
Now, he has led larger school districts, the one in Pinellas County, Florida, which is the Tampa Bay area. He's also worked as a vice president for Scholastic, which sells books and educational tools to school systems around the country. And when he worked, when he went to work for Scholastic, leaving, I think, Pinellas County or something, he said that he had found his passion. But he told Time Warner Cable News that he's excited to come here because our values, our vision, and our passion all lined up. Which is it? Does he have a passion for working for Scholastic or for being a school board?
His passion has last 3 years.
His passion is talking points, apparently. He's good
at that. We were able to talk to him, you know, shortly after the announcement,
right.
Which, you know, he got back with us really quickly. And, yeah, it was a good conversation. I mean, there were a lot of things that now I think, if I had known more, because we had about a half an hour turnaround between the press conference, I could have asked him about this and this and that. But he said it made sense that he had been hearing about CMS through Peter Gorman, actually, and heard it was a good place and that the city was really good and that there was movement from his family to move down here, too.
His grown children are talking about living here even before he got the job.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. But sure, I mean, there is that question that, you know, he was in Tampa Bay for a few years, and actually when he was there, they made a decision to change the student assignment plan, and that was after sort of federal monitoring of desegregation went away, and they had a lot of busing.
So is that the new era that the Tampa Bay Times talked about? When he left that job, the Tampa Bay Times called him the candid and often controversial superintendent who pushed the Pinellas County school system into a new era. Is that what they're talking about?
Yes, that's partly what they're talking about, and he does seem very candid. I mean, just in that 15-minute phone conversation we had with him. But yes, they reversed their student assignment plan and cut down on the length of bus trips. And he left then 6 months after that, unexpectedly, to take the Scholastic job. And he had been a proponent of, you know, cutting down on the amount of rides kids were taking. And, you know, what we see now in Tampa Bay is a very an area that is, you know, there's some very struggling schools that are, you know, highly highly poor African American kids there too. So they've had a really hard time adjusting to that. Now, he pointed out at that time, he said, if we're doing this, we have to give a lot more resources to those struggling schools. And it looks like that hadn't happened over the years following his
departure. He's been in Hagerstown, which is almost a bedroom community now of the D.C. suburbs, but it's way out there. But he's been in Hagerstown, and it's a small system. It's like 22,000 students.
22,000.
But he's been there for 5.5 years, and the school board in Hagerstown, at least somebody on the school board, expressed regret that he had decided to leave after 6 years. He just signed a new 4-year contract with them, but evidently support on that board was rocky as well. Should that concern us?
I asked him about that, and what he said, he felt that was not a commentary on his performance, but because the Board of Education was about to change, and that some on the State Board of Education, or not State Board, I'm sorry, the local Board of Education, didn't want to extend his contract when there was going to be a whole other board in. So I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but that was his explanation for that split decision.
Our school board, which had a split decision on hiring him, and he'll start July 1st, our school board is scheduled to have already finalized a new school assignment plan by the time he gets here. Do we know if he's happy with coming into a new school system, only to be saddled with a plan that will shake up lives and one in which he had no input? Or is that really a relief?
I asked him about the student assignment plan and that part of it. But first, I mean, he said, so far, the plan really resonates with him. And of course, we've just CMS has just done the magnet part of it. But he said that resonated with him. And I said, so, you know, how do you feel about coming in at the end of this? Because that's when he'll come in. And he had a good diplomatic answer. He said, you know, yes, in some ways it takes some of the pressure off. But then you also have people say, you didn't go through the struggle with us to get to this this point.
He will be paid $280,000 a year and given a four-year contract. How does that compare with his predecessor's compensation packages?
Oh, gosh. I should know. I think it's pretty equal, right?
It's about on par.
Okay. Yeah.
He was supposed to be a guest on this program on Monday, but his schedule changed, and he'll be on, I guess, after the first of the year now.
Already dodging you, Mike.
That's okay.
Been talking to the governor?
Yes. Indeed he has. There's also the school board is involved this week in voting 7-1 to approve a $798 million list of projects for the 2017 bond vote. This list was first drawn up 2 years ago, in 2015. It's been altered a bit. What's on it?
Well, it's about $800 million. There's two new high schools. There's several new elementary schools. The high schools, I believe, are southeastern and southwestern parts of the county, a bunch of new elementaries and some renovations. So no big surprises, but because they've been talking about this for a while now.
But there was debate and some disagreements on setting priorities where they're not on that list for things like athletic facilities for West Charlotte High, bigger schools to house Waddell Language Academy programs. Board members in the south suburbs want money for their things, and people other places. Has all that been resolved?
Well, they've voted. Those did not get that money. So the school boards voted and passed how it is. So
is it resolved? I'm not sure. I mean, for example, I live up in the north area of the county, and the representative from the north zone, Rhonda Lennon, is not happy with the amount of money that's going that way. It's only about $54 million or something of the $804 million. So, that's a sore spot.
Yeah. And she was the one no vote, I believe.
Right.
So all of this played out, I guess it was Tuesday night, Wednesday night, whenever they meet, with a new student advisor seated on the school board. I hope I say her name correctly. Sanaye Wilson, S-A-N-I-Y-E.
That sounds good to me. Okay. I don't know.
from Providence High School. And it didn't take her long to chime in. She challenged the adults on the board to do a better job of addressing audience concerns over the priorities of those bond funds, which they were talking about. And then Superintendent Ann Clark tried to explain some of the issues. But she said that during that explanation, she saw audience members shaking their heads as the discussion went on, and she pointed out that they were obviously angry over something, so perhaps this issue isn't settled. So she was on the board for, 5 minutes. She can't vote, and she's proven that she's not a shrinking violet.
Good for her.
That's pretty amazing to
good
talk to
her.
Power like that. Yes, good for her. Will they regret this decision of putting a student
We'll see.
Well, I can't wait for the joint CMS County Board of Commissioners meeting, and they should absolutely sit her right next to Bill James.
Okay. The number of Mecklenburg County residents living in poverty evidently has increased by 15%. This is according to a recently released census data from 2007 to 2011. Although the census is taken every 10 years, they're constantly working during the year on various surveys. This means that we have 148,000 people in Mecklenburg living in poverty. Do we understand why this number is growing? Is it because salaries are decreasing, more people are unemployed for some reason, or more people are moving here without jobs? What do we know?
Well, the answer to all those questions is yes, all of the above. Okay. All those things are happening, and that's one of the reasons. The area I'd be really concerned about is Mint Hill.
Yes, I was surprised.
That percentage
the poorest
is up
area.
To 30%. It is extremely challenging to try and govern a town when you have that much of your percentage population living on that poverty line. And it definitely is going to be something that they're going to have to work on, not only Mint Hill, but the county as a whole.
So we have about 90 seconds left, and I want to end on an up note. For the first time, Nick Oxner from WBTV News has something positive to say about things, because you like to get under the skin of people. I've noticed that about you.
Guilty.
The city of Charlotte got itself a new city manager. I think he went into office when?
Well, he did it in secret, so we don't know.
It was a very private ceremony. Nobody was there.
A couple weeks ago, I think.
It was very transparent.
His name is Marcus Jones. He came from Norfolk, Virginia, where he was chief deputy city manager overseeing administration and finance. You covered him there.
Well, then he was first a deputy, and then he was city manager.
And then you covered him when you were working
city
in
manager,
Norfolk.
Yes.
But this week, you ran a story on WBTV on the legacy he left behind there. What did you report?
We talked to four different people, a councilman, the police union president, the former president. president of the school board and a professor, all of them had glowingly positive things to say about him and said he's forward-thinking.
And universally praised, even when you pressed to try to get a negative comment.
I mean, literally, I tried, like, okay, you told me all this gushing great stuff. Tell me one bad thing or, you know, drawback about him, and no one had one. So, look, he's left behind a lot of people who are happy with the job that he did in Norfolk, and they all say he can tackle. Norfolk is a city that faces a lot of the same issues that Charlotte's trying to deal with right now in terms of poverty, in terms of police-community relations, and they all said he's the man to tackle the job.
Wow. Okay, well, if you're looking for dirt and can't find it, there probably isn't any.
Or at least not yet. I mean, stay tuned.
All right, that's Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News, along with Sean Flynn, managing editor of the Charlotte Newsroom of Time Warner Cable News, and David Borax and Lisa Wharf from WFAE News. That would be us. I could get that right, I think. Thanks all for the hour. Appreciate it.